It's Wednesday, August 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, China further devalues its currency. How was modern Asia shaped by World War II?
So after the war, really, I think most countries in Asia were left with despondency that colonialism obviously didn't work for them, that those powers had been defeated. The answer of Japanese hadn't worked for them, although there had been some collaboration. So they really wanted to find their own way.
And Charlie Puth releases his first album. It's all ahead. Well, as we heard, China has allowed the value of its currency to drop for a second day, repeating a surprise move Tuesday that rattled global markets and could raise tensions with its trade competitors. The Chinese yuan's value fell 1.6% Wednesday after falling nearly 2% a day earlier, which was its biggest single-day drop in a decade. China's central bank, which strictly controls the currency, described the move as temporary and meant to make the value of the yuan more market-oriented. I spoke with VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok about the situation. Why did Beijing make this decision to devolve the currency?
Well, there's probably a couple of reasons, although they haven't really explicitly explained this. One is that by allowing it to move, it is going to make Chinese exports more competitive. And that is the way that some of the analysts are looking at it. In a sense, the Beijing gets to export its problems to the rest of the world is one way it's being put. China, of course, has been criticized for keeping the yuan undervalued to make its exports more competitive. There's also perhaps another reason, and China wants to have its currency included in the basket of traded currencies of the International Monetary Fund. And by allowing the currency to fluctuate more freely, that is going to gain a favorable reaction, presumably from the IMF. And they quickly issued a statement, in fact, saying that greater exchange rate flexibility is important for China as it strives to give market forces a decisive role in the economy and rapidly integrates into the global financial markets.
What has been the impact so far this week on China's decision to devalue its currency on Asian markets?
Well, in the Tuesday and Wednesday sessions, what we've seen is this really significant ripple effect, not only through foreign currencies, but also commodities, bonds, and stock prices, especially in the emerging markets. Of course, the concern being that if things become more expensive for Chinese to buy in China, for the countries that are trying to export their products to China, they're going to be less competitive. Now, very interestingly, Vietnam has gone ahead and done what China did the previous day, which is loosened its trading ban. It's one of the currencies that does not trade freely. We have not seen such interventions explicitly by governments in the foreign currency market so far, but there is some concern that it won't only be Vietnam doing this, that we could soon have quite a widespread currency war.
From the analysts that you have spoken to, do they think that these actions will allow China's currency to stabilize?
There's really a very mixed view of that. On one hand, when you allow your currency to be at the mercy of the market, it can get out of control and go in directions that central governments don't necessarily want it to go in. What we saw at the in the closing minutes and seconds of the Wednesday session in the currency market, there was obvious intervention to pump up the currency significantly so that the ban for the next day is more in line, presumably, with what the central bankers in China desire.
All right, Steve, thank you very much for speaking with me today. All right, that's VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman. Now, joining me here in the studio is Susan Yaki. Now, you've been looking, Susan, at some of the social media response to what's going on in China.
Right, right. A group of us have been. There's been a lot of talk about the Chinese currency devaluation on social media. In the last day, there have been 80,000 tweets mentioning the yuan, according to the Twitter analytics site Topsy. It even has its own hashtag, hashtag yuan. And that's been trending since yesterday. Across Twitter, we've been seeing some financial institutions and market analysts reacting positively to the devaluations. The International Monetary Fund is praising the move from the People's Bank of China via Twitter, using the handle at IMF News, tweeting, PBC move should allow market forces to have a greater role in determining the yuan exchange rate. So far, that's been retweeted more than 100 times. Another positive mention comes from a market analyst at IG in Switzerland, Andreas Ruhlmann, using the Twitter handle at @aruhlmann_IG. He tweeted, "A China move to free up its currency is best way to gain credibility as a maturing economy going forward." And we're also seeing some more negative tweets suggesting this may be the start of a currency war between China and its neighbors. Peter Thal Larsen, the Asia editor for Reuters Breaking Views, says the Twitter handle @Peter_TL tweeted, "Summing up the yuan depreciation, I am making the exchange rate market-based. You are devaluing to boost growth. He is starting a currency war." So Sarah, the discourse on social media is fairly mixed so far, but the number of people talking about the yuan devaluation is certainly growing. And we wanted to thank Olin Akishoglu for gathering this information with us. Thank you, Sarah.
Okay, thank you. That is Susan Yaki. Well, in other news, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says it's very likely his emails are read by the Chinese and Russians, both of whom have been accused of recent cyber attacks on U.S. government targets. The U.S. has blamed China for a series of high-profile cyber attacks on U.S. government and business entities in recent years. China has strongly denied the allegations. And U.S. defense officials believe that Russia-based state-sponsored hackers may have been behind a July cyber attack on the Pentagon's Joint Chiefs of Staff email network. Well, for more on all of this, I'm joined by VOA's cyber correspondent, Doug Bernard. So, Doug, you know, what about Kerry and his emails?
Well, this, I guess, should really take nobody as by surprise. And I think the interesting thing here is just how frank Secretary Kerry is being in his assessment. As you previously mentioned, his exact quote is, "It's very likely." It is not outside the realm of possibility. And he went on to add that, you know, whether others had been hacked, he said, well, it's very possible. I certainly write things with that awareness. I think that's the key part of that right there. I think there is a sense among government officials in the United States, and especially as you go up higher in the ranks, that these emails are not always secure. And increasingly, I think they're conducting themselves and writing their correspondence with that in mind.
How is it known how this is done?
Yes, it is known how it's done. It's also known how to stop it. The reason it keeps happening is because, well, several reasons. One, because it is just simply so easy. The internet was never built to be a secure system. It was always intended to be an open system. This decades ago, when the idea of people hacking emails, this just wasn't even in the thought process at the time. And the second thing is the more people that you have in any organization or institution, the easier it is it's going to be to penetrate those computer systems. If it's just you and me, say, on a computer system, we can be pretty assured of keeping it safe as long as you do your part and I'll do my part.
Right.
But when you have thousands and thousands of people, all you need is one. All you need is one to slip up and click that wrong link or open a document they shouldn't have or something, and then bam, everybody's infected.
Well, now, this is a little bit of a speculative question here, but does the U.S. read emails of their leaders? Because there was a case of the U.S. was monitoring
yes.
the private phone calls of German
yes.
Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Yes. Well, the NSA's its mission is to monitor international digital traffic and communications. So you can be assured that the NSA, working with its partners, there's a group of five nations. I think it's known as the Five Eyes, colloquially, that these nations are, yes, they're doing everything they can to intercept, to read, Perhaps not as perhaps with as much splash as we've seen coming from China and Russia, hacking the State Department, hacking the White House, recently hacking the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Those are kind of high-profile things. I think what the United States is doing is a lot more low-key, but probably at least as much as the Chinese and the Russians.
Okay, thanks very much. That's VOA's Doug Bernard. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A newly updated index of sunspot numbers over the last 400 years may have eliminated a key argument used by those who question human-caused climate change. Some of those who suggest that climate change is not anthropogenic in nature contend that changes in the sun's activity are responsible for any increase or decrease in global temperatures. The new sunspot index, called the Sunspot Number Version 2.0, shows that solar activity has been constant over the past few centuries without any noteworthy long-term upward trends in solar activity since 1700. Creators of the new Sunspot Index say this means that any rise in global temperatures since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution cannot be attributed to an increase in solar activity. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about Charlie Puth's new album. This week marks the 70th anniversary of Japan's surrender to U.S.-led Allied forces, ending World War II. In a new article for the online magazine The Diplomat, author Paul French discusses the lingering ghosts that have haunted Asia since the end of the war. He's the author of the recent books Midnight in Peking and North Korea, State of Paranoia. I spoke to French about how Asia was shaped following the huge conflict. Coming out of that, countries in Asia, such as China and Vietnam, North Korea, what was the attraction of sort of an Asian version of communism?
Well, I think, of course, before the war, the European colonial powers had been very involved, as had Japan, and Japan, of course, had been tried to be dominant during the war. So after the war, really, I think most countries in Asia were left with despondency that colonialism obviously didn't work for them, that those powers had been defeated. The answer of Japanese hadn't worked for them, although there had been some collaboration. So they really wanted to find their own way. And I think, you know, communism at that time offered an idea of self-reliant nationalism, a third way between domination by another country through colonialism or through war.
Ironically, this led to the establishment of a number of family legacies, and it's really amazing. I mean, the Nehru Gandhi family, the Bhuttos, the Kim family. There have been so many. I mean, that's such a sort of somewhat of a, I think, you know, kind of contradiction in terms, in a way.
Well, I think that many of the people who had been involved in really collaborating with the Japanese during the war really were either killed or completely finished politically. They weren't taken seriously afterwards. What came was the people who were able to be seen as people who had won the war, which even though he was defeated by the communists, Chiang Kai-shek was in China, even when he went to Taiwan afterwards, or people who had led partisan efforts against the Japanese. So, yeah, you're quite right, that people from very varying backgrounds, such as Sukarno in the Dutch East Indies, that immediately in 1945 he declared was Indonesia and not part of the Dutch Empire anymore. Kim Il-sung, of course, in North Korea, through to his son Kim Jong-il, through now to Kim Jong-un. Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan, of course, that moved on to Chiang Ching-kuo, his son. And now, of course, you could also argue that we've seen that in Singapore with the Lee family, and also now, of course, with Aung San, who was really the father of modern Burma just after the war, and now with the new junta-free and reforming Burma with Aung San Suu Kyi, his daughter.
Well, looking at the lingering ghosts in China, to this day, I mean, there's Mao's portrait in Tiananmen Square, the mausoleum to him, his picture is on the currency, and yet again, officially, you know, the country remains communist and still keeps him as this figure, sort of overlooking the country.
Yes, I mean, I think it does, and I think it, of course, this is part of that post-war nationalism and national self-reliance that had to be so strong. But and that is also true if you go to North Korea, and, of course, if you go to Vietnam, you'll see Ho Chi Minh everywhere. If you go to North Korea, you'll see Kim Il-sung everywhere. And this also happens with founding nation states in Malaysia, in Indonesia, and, of course, in India with Gandhi and so on, right across the continent. But what it also means is that often change cannot come until that person has passed on. And certainly that was the case in China. You know, Mao had to really pass his sell-by date and really had to die before Deng could do anything. And I think that's also true of Sukarno in Indonesia. It's also true of Gandhi in India, even, of course, even though he was very revered. That those initial leaders have to go, but they can still remain revered in portraits, and as you say, on Tiananmen Square or on the money or big portraits everywhere. But they have to pass so that then the next generation can take it on from the National Liberation Movement. Where that doesn't happen, of course, you then end up with terrible stasis, which is what you have, of course, in North Korea, where there has never really been a move away from the central commanding family.
Are these ghosts ever able to be exorcised in a way? When you look at what's going on now with disputes in the South China Sea, and even North Korea announced that it's changing its time because there's a legacy of the Japanese, you know, past. Can Asia ever be rid of some of these ghosts?
Look, Sarah, ghosts can be exorcised if you choose not to believe in them. Right? The moment you choose not to believe in them, they're gone. But, of course, governments, particularly in China and North Korea, cling quite a lot to that period and to what they feel were the injustices of that period, real and imagined. You know, if you can keep arguing, if you're the North Korean government, that your lockdown, your clampdown on society is because you saved the country from Japanese domination, and hence, if you don't keep on doing that, then South Korea, backed by America, backed by Japan, they'll all try and invade you. And again, for the Communist Party in China, which really argues in part that its legitimacy extends from the end of the Second World War and the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, you know, this idea that you have to keep the fires bubbling away with Japan in the South China Sea, talking all the time about whether a sufficient apology has been given or not, this is all about maintaining regimes that exist at the moment by using these historical ghosts. The moment they choose not to believe in those ghosts, as many countries in Asia have and don't get so worked up about, so they just disappear.
Thanks very much, Paul, for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Sarah.
That is author Paul French, and this is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Charlie Puth first gained international fame through the internet and his YouTube videos. Then his song See You Again was number one for weeks. Now he's about to release his first album and has a new duet with Meghan Trainor, Marvin Gaye. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA's Larry London spoke about the song and about some health problems that Meghan is having.
First, she had a hit duet with John Legend. Now Meghan Trainor is back with Charlie Puth, a tribute song, Marvin Gaye. Larry, tell me about this song.
It's a great song, and it's actually Charlie Puth's first solo release from his upcoming album, which is called Some Type of Love. It's an EP that is his first album ever. He's been a social media phenom. Back in 2009, he started putting stuff on YouTube and got very, very popular that way. And now he's got his own record. Of course, you know him from the number one hit See You Again, which spent 12 weeks at number one from the film Furious 7. It was a duet with Wiz Khalifa featuring Charlie Puth. Now we've got Charlie Puth featuring Meghan Trainor with Marvin Gaye.
Let's Marvin Gaye and get it on. You got the healing that I want. Just like they say in the song. Till the dawn, let's Marvin Gaye and get it on.
But if you want to hear Meghan, I understand you might want to listen to this record because she's having some vocal problems again.
Yeah, again, this seems to be a reoccurring issue with a lot of different singers. She canceled a number of shows several months ago, resumed the tour. Unfortunately, as of today, she has postponed her tour again because of throat problems.
Now, is this going to require surgery, or do we know that yet?
Not known yet. It might. Like Sam Smith had a vocal hemorrhage on one of his vocal cords, and he underwent surgery and spent 2 months in rehab, so maybe Meghan Trainor will have to undergo the same situation. Who knows? A lot of these singers have throat problems. She's only 20, and her throat is not used to this kind of wear and tear because she's a songwriter, remember? That's how she came up through the ranks.
Yeah, she's not used to being in front of, you know, thousands of people putting on a show because that can take its toll. I know that there's several high-profile country artists that Nikki Strong and I talked about who had the same problem. It's either a node or it's a like a callus on mm-hmm. their vocal cords or the blood vessels rupture, like Sam Smith. And that's nothing to be played with. You can literally lose your voice or do permanent damage to your vocal cords if you don't get that taken care of.
It's one of the hazards of the business that they're in, because when you have a popular song, you have to be out promoting it. And when it's popular on the charts, everybody wants you to perform it on their talk shows and in concerts and whatnot. So she probably, on average, I would guess any singer, sings a song when it's popular 3-4 times a day.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because one of my guitar heroes, James Taylor, said that Tony Bennett asked him, are you still doing your vocal exercises? And he said, no, not really. And Tony, who is now like 86 or 87 and still performing, said, no, you got to do that every day. You got to make sure you do that or you'll lose the voice.
Wow. I didn't realize that. Maybe I need to get that book.
Really? All right. Well, you know, if you have a comment about this, you can send Larry a tweet. He's at @VOA_music. Also, look for his show, Border Crossings. You can find that on our website, www.voanews.com.
That is music by Charlie Puth and Meghan Trainor. And that's our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
ISIL is continuing its assault on innocent civilians with its latest kidnappings in the central Syrian province of Homs, where the terrorist group abducted an estimated 230 people, including some Christians. ISIL's attacks have also resulted in the displacement of an estimated 2,000 people from nearby villages. According to the State Department's 2014 Human Rights Report, some communities under rule by ISIL experience specialized religious taxes, or jizya, forced religious conversions, destruction of religious sites, and expulsion of minority communities. Christians make up 10% of Syria's population of more than 17 million people. In February, ISIL attacked predominantly Assyrian Christian villages in the northeast Syrian province of Hasaka, where they kidnapped dozens of civilians, including women, children, priests, and the elderly. ISIL also burned and destroyed homes and churches. Those attacks displaced an estimated 3,000 people. The fact that ISIL deliberately targets civilians further testifies to its rampant criminality and brutality against all those who disagree with its toxic beliefs. ISIL continues to exact its evil upon innocents of all faiths, and the majority of its victims have been Muslim. People of all faiths and many religious leaders throughout the region have united in condemning ISIL's depravity, its mass killings, rape, sexual enslavement, lashing, stoning, crucifixion, and public murder of hostages. The violence in Syria has killed more than 250,000 people. The United States demands an immediate and unconditional release of all civilians taken captive by ISIL. To help bring an end to these horrors, the United States remains committed to leading the global coalition to counter ISIL.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.